Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
The anti-Beach Boys. The Beach Boys, everything was sunny and beach and girls and fast cars and life was great. The Bee Gees are in the rain and it's dark. No one's around and just they feel isolated.
Hi there, everyone. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. My name is Patrick Foster. On behalf of Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you to this episode of Pre-Disco Bee Gees. I want to thank once again Paul Hayden for his interest in this, doing some research and passion that he brought to this topic, which I personally find very fascinating. Such interesting music made in the mid to late 60s by the Bee Gees, and so interesting to already know where they went from here, but it's cool to go back and learn about their history. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about being into music, popular music, whatever kind of music that you're into, is you get in at a certain point, you jump in the river, you start swimming, you start floating, you start riding a boat or whatever. And there's all this other stuff that happened in the big stream before you got there. So you get to go back and explore it, which is nice. You can get up on shore, ride back, and jump back in the river at a certain point and learn about this stuff that happened in the 60s and early 70s. And if I haven't already killed the metaphor, float on. Anyway, thanks a lot, Paul, for your work on this. And we're going to continue now with part two on our topic. If you remember yesterday at the end of the episode, we had heard that Bee Gees had just put out their first album. We learned about the covers that were being created for them, and it was a upward trajectory that the band was on. And we're going to begin now in the year 1968. Well, actually, late 1967, the beginning of 1968, and we'll hand it over to Paul to pick up the narrative on the Bee Gees pre-disco.
So now we're moving into 1968, but at the end of 67, they released a single called World, not to be confused with Words, which had me confused for many years. But World is one of those songs where you start to see that the Bee Gees really pick up on what's trending, what's popular, because you got some really wicked guitar on this one that I don't think I've ever heard since. Just a really psychedelic, for them, freak out in the middle. And yet it was a single.
Or am I needed here? Now I found that the world is round. And of course, it rains every day. If I remember all of the things I have done, I remember all of the times I've gone wrong. Why do they keep me here? Now I found that the world is round, and of course it rains every day.
And of course it arrives.
me of that Carpenter song, crazy fuzz guitars, like twice.
Yeah, Richard went nuts on those two sections, man.
Yeah, I mean, so and this is something that would kind of hurt them also later on, where they follow the trends a little too much rather than trusting their instincts. But for them, you know, the single did, it kept them on the charts, and mm-hmm. they're doing well. I mean, they're selling records, they're touring, they're playing arenas. They're in the chips. So one thing I want to also point out here is that Robin and Morris were born on the winter solstice, which the author is saying that could be part of why they're maybe not so optimistic.
Interesting.
The anti-Beach Boys. The Beach Boys, everything was sunny and beach and girls and fast cars and life was great. The Bee Gees are in the rain and it's dark.
Yeah.
You know, I can't... No one's around, and just they feel isolated. It's interesting. And I should mention at this point about Morris, who doesn't really sing, but he was a good instrumentalist. He would play bass,
keyboards,
and harmonize as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he's overlooked, but he has some good ideas, and his bass playing and keyboards were a big part of their sound. So I don't want to forget Morris.
Yeah, absolutely. Great shout.
So second album, Horizontal, comes out in February of 68. And the big song there was Massachusetts, a place they had never been to. But, you know, they liked how it flowed in the song. And they said, you know, it's really just about being away from some place you want to be, whether you're on tour or traveling for some reason, and you just want to get back to where you feel at home. And that feeling, that isolation, that stays with them. And they never felt like they had a home. I mean, they were in England, then they go to Australia, and they come back to England. It's like they don't have roots. So I think that kind of rootlessness is a big part of their songwriting.
I'm going back to Massachusetts. Something's telling me I must go home.
So Massachusetts was number 11 in the U.S. Also, crucially, and we'll come to this later, their first U.K. number one.
Mm.
And this is Robin singing lead. So something to keep in mind. The other big song from that era was a single that came out after the album called Words. And this one got to be pretty big to the point where Elvis, when he's out in Vegas, added it to his set. And if you listen to Neil Young's Deep Forbidden Lake, it's pretty much the same melody. So they were reaching everybody at this point, except, you know, all the big singers. You know, you got Janis Joplin, you got Elvis, Neil Young. I'm sure there are many more, but they're definitely getting bigger and bigger.
Mind-blowing. I actually put on the Neil Young song right after the Bee Gees song, and I was like, oh my God, this is so right on. It really is. I mean, just crazy.
Smile, an everlasting smile. A smile can bring you near to me. Don't ever let me find you gone, 'cause that would bring a tear to me. This world has lost its glory. Let's start a brand new story now, my love. Right now, there'll be no other time, and I can show you how, my love. Talk in everlasting words and dedicate them all to me.
On the boats, the old and creaky boats, the shoreline goes gliding by, and the wind that was a dying breeze is making the banners fly. See the colors floating on the sky, the pride of the captain's eye, as he guides his slender craft inside and opens up the door.
So then we get to the end of the year, the second half of 1968. Mm-hmm. And as one did when you were in a band in the 60s, you just cranked out albums, you know,
yes,
one after the other. So their third album, Idea, comes out in September. And the big song on this one was I've Got to Get a Message to You.
Yeah.
That's their first U.S. top 10 song. And again, strange choice of lyrics. I mean, it's written from the vantage point of a prisoner on death row. Not your usual topic, I don't think.
Not at all.
But Barry, at the time, had a pretty strong opinion on capital punishment and wanted to write a song about it. So, hey. And I never picked up on that all the years I'd heard it. But then you
said
the lyrics, you know. It's my turn to die. Okay, literally. So,
yeah.
Again, keeping it kind of different, but very successful. Top 10. Then the last single from the album was I Started a Joke. It's one of my favorites. Again, just another Robin song where the lyrics don't quite make sense, but he sure does paint a picture.
Which started the whole world crying, but I didn't see that the joke was on me. Oh no, I started to cry, which started
That song hit number 6 in the U.S., which is their highest showing. They're moving up the charts, moving on up.
And, you know, interestingly, the records were released in the U.K. on RSO, and I'm not sure if they were released on RSO or ATCO or a different label in the United States. I can't remember, but I don't know. Do you have any sense how they were marketed in the U.S., like in the late 60s, you know, post-Summer of Love? You know, Vietnam turbulence and all these things happening. I don't know if they were marketed as an English pop band, because they were a lot more than that. You know, when you listen to the lyrics and, you know, as you said, it's the sweet melodies on the surface. But I wonder, you know, how they were perceived by, you know, general music consumers at that time.
I don't know. That's a great question.
Yeah, I don't know either.
My sense is that they were just like, well, you know, it's still, Beatles are still together. So here's a band that sounds like the Beatles.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
Just buy their stuff. It's good stuff. And, you know, they're still kind of staying in that pop framework. They're not really expanding their sound just yet, because that's where they feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Which, again, will kind of come back to haunt them later on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's what they do. And, you know, 1968 ends, and they feel like they're doing what they want to do. They keep getting higher on the charts. So the next step, obviously, is to make a concept album, right?
Well, it was 1968, so
prog rock, progressive rock, whatever you want to call it, is starting to take over as Sgt. Pepper and, I guess, their Satanic Majesty's Request.
Mm-hmm.
The Who, what was that one? Sell Out?
Yeah, Sell Out, yep. And right before Tommy, a couple years before Tommy, yep.
So the big boys are starting to expand their palette, and the Moody Blues, Genesis, other bands are getting noticed. So even Space Oddity, which...
Yeah, good point.
If you listen to the first verse, very similar to New York Mining Disaster, you know, it's like he's out in space. He's got no one near him. What's going to happen? I don't know. Isolated.
We're in a stairwell.
Robert Stigwood says, you know what, boys, it's time to not make a pop album. Let's make a rock album. Let's make a statement. Let's put out a concept album. So they put together Odessa,
mm-hmm.
a double album, and I'm fuzzy on what the album, what the concept really is, but we can come back to this one if we need to flesh it out. But I think for my purpose, it just kind of showed some of the internal workings of the band were getting a little cracked.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When it was time to pick a single, Stigwood wanted First of May, which was a Barry song.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin thought, well, I think Lamplight, which is a great song.
It is a great song.
Should have been the single if I was their manager, but it wasn't. And Robin was really, really upset. He thought that since he sang on Massachusetts, which was the first number one, I should sing on all the singles going forward. Clearly, I'm the one that people like. And
right.
Barry and Morris and Robert Stigwood are like, nah, I don't think that's how it's going to work. So Robin just says, all right, I'm done. I'm quitting the band. So Odessa comes out, not the most successful concept album of the day, but I think it forced them all to just kind of rethink where they're at and where they want to go.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, you know, obviously at that time it was pretty de rigueur for bands to have a manager who was heavily involved in, you know, the creation of the project, right? And the direction of the music and the songs. And I recently saw the Led Zeppelin documentary that came out. And, you know, the story of the first Led Zeppelin album was that Jimmy Page and Peter Grant paid for all the studio time, recorded the entire album, mixed it was finished, and they took it to the record label and said, this is what we're doing. And really, Peter Grant didn't have any say in that either. It was just Jimmy Page. And, you know, so I think it's the Bee Gees were in a very typical situation, because what happened with Led Zeppelin was completely unusual. Like, you never heard of that happening in the late 60s at all. At least from what I read and what I understood, and I absolutely can't wait to read the book. Maurice was, you know, Robin was at the point where he thought, you know, Robert Stigwood was definitely on Barry's side completely. And, you know, that he didn't see a way out, I guess.
Right. I think he had just gotten fed up, and there, I'm sure there was more to it. I mean,
yeah,
in terms of, you know, in the studio, who did they pay attention to? Who did they listen to? Is probably, and Barry being the older brother.
Yes, that's it too. Yep.
He's the natural leader. But Robin's just like, you know what? I think I need to do something else. Moving up the charts, moving on up.